Right now, we've touched on this in a bunch of different ways perhaps already, but right now in the midst of this pandemic, there are lots of things that we can't do. I'm not going to make a list for a couple of reasons. One is I don't think it would be a positive experience. The other is that I couldn't be exhaustive anyway because we all miss different things. And that's you know, legit. It's possible that reflecting on what we miss can also be regarded as lamenting. And a really legitimate part of grief or a grief process, if you think of it that way. To which I would just make the observation that if lamenting what we can't do or what's lost is part of grieving, then let's lean into it. Let's lament in detail and let's grieve with some depth. Let's do this as though it were the essential personal work that it is and just dig right in and lament away. I think actually lost lament is something maybe we're in the process of recovering as communities of wealth and privilege, relatively speaking, in the world. And I think that's on balance probably a good thing. This is not me arguing that the pandemic is a good thing, just to be clear. It's hard to keep a wider perspective when we're struggling. And so this can be a hard thing to do, you know. And so sometimes, because that's a challenge, sometimes our lamenting isn't part of grieving. Sometimes our lamenting just turns into whining as part of that, facing that difficulty. And I want to explore that a bit this morning in conjunction with that something that I said I would return to, which is the idea of ecological metaphors for responding to the challenge of this pandemic by seeking what I'm going to call this morning balance or integration. As I said a couple of weeks ago, our gravitation in this part of the world toward war metaphors for responding to this current situation is understandable. We seem to have a need to respond to uncertainty by placing it into a framework of meaning that sort of seems to be built in. And the metaphor of war is an easily accessed one because we've used it before. We know something about war as a society, and it can be readily leveraged to motivate a collective response. And so those are all things that make it sort of accessible, an easy tool to grab out of the toolbox. As we noted previously, there are also some downsides. I'm not going to revisit those now because in the world of virtual gatherings, if you care to hear my thoughts about the downsides of that, you can go back a couple of talky bits and watch the live stream or listen to the podcast. But what I do want to do this morning is look forward at some other ways of thinking about this moment in our lives and what other kinds of stories or metaphors we might find helpful as we sort of tiptoe toward whatever's coming next. I'm not sure how it feels to you, but I'm still sort of having that forward back sensation a lot these days, and it can be confusing and disconcerting, even while it can also stir up fresh hope, you know. So anyway, as we kind of lean forward a little bit, there's some things here I think that'll be worth keeping in mind. As I've reflected on all of this, I find that I'm drawn towards stories and metaphors and possible actions that feel as though they're about life, about living with as much depth and connectedness and groundedness, as much sort of integration of body, mind, and spirit as I can. I can't make any claim to doing this especially well. I don't think I do these things well, but I can say that this pandemic has prompted me to reflect on the state of the world around me from some different vantage points than I normally otherwise would. And one of those vantage points has been that of seeking balance, which in many ways is an idea that can be used interchangeably for an idea or a word like integration. So I might flip back and forth between those two word ideas this morning, but that's why. And it seems also to me that some of the most accessible metaphors in that process come from ecological images. To harken back to an article that I cited a couple of weeks ago, Alyssa Wilkinson's Vox article, Pandemics Are Not Wars, in that article, she puts this idea this way. She says, instead of thinking of this pandemic as a war, us versus them, humans versus invading virus, what if we reframed our thinking to imagine our goal as finding balance, not only in the natural world, but in our social and cultural worlds as well? And then she goes on in that article to talk about the 2019 documentary, The Biggest Little Farm, and how the folks at the center of that documentary, a family who run a biodynamic family farm, how over the course of several years of operating this farm, they've come to see pests or problems on the farm not as evidence that they were being invaded by an enemy that needed to be attacked or destroyed, but as evidence that something on the farm was out of balance. When I reread that this morning when I was going over my notes, I was just like, the tentacles from that idea, the creepers from that idea, to stay in the plant world maybe just a little bit in terms of images, just go like everywhere. They really reach into so many realms of how we would think about life. One of the things that a metaphor like that does, though, is it brings it back to us. We don't get to take the idea of something that's wrong and just set it apart from us as though we had nothing to do with it. We have to tend to the things that might be the cause or that might help the thing that is wrong or awry to find its way back toward balance. And there's usually work for us to do as humans in that. Maybe that's why we really like the them and us-ing of enemy versus friend in that war metaphor. It simplifies that complexity, but not necessarily in a helpful way. Anyway, if we consider this pandemic in light of an idea like that, that something might be out of balance as opposed to being under attack, we might start to see that there are ways that we are living on the planet that contribute to our vulnerability to an experience like this. And that sort of lens can help us consider wider changes we may need to make to see how the enormous imbalances in things like economic equality or food security or community interconnectedness or the removal of forests from the planet or the fragility of an ideal like global supply chains, that those might all be areas we need to attend to if we want to not just sort of make this go away, but also become a global community that's better equipped to prevent the sort of widespread upheaval that we're presently experiencing. And again, not an exhaustive list. Now, that can all pretty quickly start to sound so big that we just check out, right? Like it's sort of like somebody saying we need to solve world hunger and then or global climate change, and then everything that comes after that starts sounds like wah, 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 because the first idea is just so gigantic that we check out because it seems overwhelming. So this is where I want to suggest that the starting place for actually making change, even on things that are enormous when you say them fast like that, might actually be a lot more accessible than we think. And I did just say the starting place. Let me just modify that a little bit to a starting place. I think there are lots of ways we might engage with these sorts of things. Perhaps it's closer to universally true to say we need to engage with this, and this is one way we might begin. So from that vantage point, it might seem like a bit of an odd starting place, but I'm going to suggest that the baseline for becoming more deeply engaged human beings is the integration of what we believe and what we experience. And the reason I wanted to kind of draw that together as a statement is because I do believe that as long as our spirituality, let's use that language, as long as our spirituality and our lived life experiences don't have anything to do with one another, we're going to keep on coming up short in our actions and their efficacy because an essential part of our humanness is sort of going to be hived off and sat to the side and relegated to this realm of sort of active irrelevance, when what we really deeply need is to be able to draw on ourselves as whole persons in order to live well, both as individuals and as a society. Even if we think of this in terms of just resources, to take the resources that we would think of or use the light ideas or language or notions of spirituality for and say, those kind of live over here. They live over here in a realm of religion, or they live over here in a realm of private practice, or they live over here in a realm of just ideology. Any of those options is to take this enormous part of who we are as human beings, this enormous way of connecting with everything, and say, oh, you know, when it comes to dealing with pandemics and world hunger and climate change and planetary deforestation and economic inequality and on, we're not going to access all of that. We're just going to sit that over there. And then, you know, on Sunday we'll access it. Or if we're feeling especially sad, we'll access it, or needy. Or if we're feeling especially gleeful or celebratory, maybe we'll tap it then. But you know, ideas? Only we need that for this, you know? Not good enough. And I think we're surrounded by a situation that can be understood, among other things, as evidence that that's not good enough. that we need to draw on the whole person. Unless we bring body, mind, and spirit to the big challenges of this world, we're just going to keep, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic instead of asking why we were going so fast when we hit the damn iceberg in the first place. That's a very messy metaphor. Let's move on. Anyway, back to the odd starting place that I was talking about. When it comes to things that we can do that can help us with deeply processing and integrating our ideas and our lived experience, including those we might think of as our faith or our beliefs, history suggests history suggests that it's still pretty tough to beat going for a walk. Now, I know I've mentioned this before, but there is a twist. I'm going to keep unpacking this. And just to be clear, there are all sorts of things that are lovely about going for a walk physiologically, and they spill over into our mental health and into our spiritual health. And of course, that's true. And we can still think of all of that sort of under the category of exercise. The category of walking I'm talking about this morning is more about contemplation. And of course, they're not mutually exclusive, but just so you get the tilt or the twist a little bit. Now, there is a long history of this. Like with so many things in the Western world, we can track this one back to the Greeks, the early Greek philosophers, who continue to have a really easily discerned large scale influence on how we think about things like governance and personhood and society these days. Those early Greek philosophers were actually called peripatetics. And peripatetic is a word which means of, relating to, or given to walking. So they walked. And the followers of Aristotle in particular were called by this name, but so were the followers of Socrates and Plato, and sort of that whole Greek gang were referred to as the peripatetics because of their habit of walking about while they kicked ideas around. See what I did there? It's, you know, you gotta have fun with words. You can't just use them like tools all the time. Anyway, Rousseau, the well-known French philosopher, walked from Paris to Geneva and back a couple of times. Now, mainly because they couldn't afford the stagecoach, but with noteworthy results, not the least of which was one of their last unfinished works, which is called Reveries of a Solitary Walker, in which Rousseau not only considers, it's a big work, considers a lot of the large ideas about human dignity and personhood and education and society shaping that they were best known for as a philosopher, but they also attend in minute detail to things like the shape of the leaves. It's an interesting thing. I mean, this wouldn't work this way for everyone, but we've got a couple of trees in our yard that have the most spectacular buds on them. I mean, I think the green of a poplar bud, which is just this little emerging, you know, minty leaf, it's pretty spectacular, but these are like these long, gorgeous, intricate collections of seed pods. They're so beautiful, and there's so much going on in them in terms of color and shape that every once in a while I find myself just standing, and they're not very big. Like each pod is, you know, maybe an inch long, but sometimes I find myself standing in the yard and just kind of looking into those seed pods and being in awe of what's going on in there. That's also present in Rousseau's work, that kind of consideration of the world around him. And then he makes the connection between those observations and what he's thinking about in terms of the shape of a good world. It's fascinating. Nietzsche, famous for his long walks in the Alps, particularly after his mental health crisis. Kierkegaard, an observably downer philosopher, kind of a bummer. He frequently took his glumness out for regular strolls on the streets of Copenhagen. And so on and on. And that's, of course, not even talking about the poets who like to get out and about. And of course, Jesus walked. And he walked so often and so much that whenever he used some other way of getting around, he rode a donkey, he took a boat, whatever, it turned into a symbolic moment. It turned into some like unique part of the story. Now, just a little sidebar here. When it comes to exploring ideas at the table, I do get and feel very conscious of the fact that the Jesus path isn't one we all have in common. In fact, for some of us, that path has not led to life, as hard an idea as that is to put into a sentence, or has led it to a curious mix of life and not life, and we're wrestling with what to do with that. I'm not making any assumptions about this being the only way to enter these ideas, but when it comes to accessing ancient wisdom, this rabbi's life is the wise one's life that I'm most familiar with, and so that's the story that I'm going to work with. But if you have some other source of ancient wisdom that you look to, I will not be at all surprised if you find significant parallels and overlaps. So, If we think for a moment about what we might learn about this idea of integration or balance from the way that Jesus walked through the world, we might start by noting that he often didn't walk alone. There were his closest followers, the people that we might refer to these days as his disciples. They would have been thought of as proteges or those who were learning from a teacher, from a rabbi. And then there were these crowds of sort of hangers-on that wanted to overhear what Jesus said to his followers, because most of what happened in terms of teaching was they walked around together, like the peripatetics, and they observed the world around them, and they talked about the connections between that world and whatever the idea was or the spiritual reality was that was being explored. And so people would just sort of hang around. They would follow along. Little noisy, little dusty, probably a little distracting. Maybe that's why we have so many different versions of so many of the Jesus stories. Some of them get a little crazy. If you really want to chase this one down, you could always look up the Monty Python sketch in which Jesus is cited as saying, blessed are the cheesemakers rather than the peacemakers. I think that might not be what he was after. But anyway, there you go. You can miss here, right? So maybe that's why, on a more serious note, maybe that's why when Jesus felt like he needed more clarity about something, and who doesn't feel that these days, he stepped away from the crowds and he walked alone. He walked into the hills that surrounded the part of the country where he lived, just by his home. And he did that to contemplate and to think and to commune, to be conscious of his spiritual connection to the divine, and sometimes just to rest, because we need that too. When Jesus wanted to figure out what was worth dying for, when he wanted to get his core spiritual values sorted, when he wanted to kind of get clarity about what are the non-negotiables for him, he went for a very long walk alone, as the story would have it, 40 days long walk alone in the wilderness. In both of those circumstances, walking with others and walking alone, it's worth noting how the very physicality, the actual embodied, sometimes sweaty, sometimes chilly, sometimes hungry, sometimes needing rest, sometimes finding rest, all of that, the dirt under your feet and on your feet and in the air around you, the crops, the trees, the birds of the fields, the blooms on the flowers, all of these things, these are all things that when Jesus talked about what he's quoted as calling the kingdom of God, he was talking about all those things. And so it's not unusual in the teaching of Jesus to find him saying something like, the kingdom of God is like, and then all of this embodied stuff. I think whatever else we can take from that, we can take it as true that what Jesus was talking about when he talked about the kingdom of God, when he talked about a world in which human and divine can be fully present and deeply present, he was talking about the material world, and he was talking about our experiences in it as an essential part of that version of reality, that picture of how reality can function best and be most integrated. In other words, walking can make an actual way for us to consider the relationship between what we believe and what we're experiencing, to consider the connections between faith and life, material and spiritual, sacred and, I don't know, like anything else. Here's a question. What if sacred experiences and connections aren't something we need to or even should wait to have until this pandemic is over, or we can all be together again, or some variation on that theme? Which is not to denigrate being together in any way. I look forward to that so much. But it is to say, it's possible for us to get stuck on that idea and miss its companion idea. Writer Alex Jackson puts it this way. I think this is quite a lovely pulling together of these ideas. He writes, "We know we're walking on sacred ground when every step we take feels like part of an unfolding ritual. Moments become laden with significance, connections, and discoveries. Our lives are framed and formed by these times and places. The path, the place, and the traveler are inseparable." I'll read that sentence again. The path, the place, and the traveler are inseparable. I cannot say where the transition into sacred territory is, or even if it exists, But if there is no boundary, then every place is sacred, and every action recognizing and respecting this is a ritual of faith. When we can feel and understand all of creation as holy, then every being and place is one. Joined in a sacred and eternal community, we know when we are there. Or to put that last sentence another way, we have to be there to know. So the integration of even our ways of knowing and our ways of experiencing the world need to come together. So ideas need to not be divorced from embodied experiences. Embodied experiences need to not be divorced from ideas. The sacred needs to not be divorced from the things that are treated as not sacred. Jackson is making the argument that it's all sacred, but we all know that not everything gets treated that way all the time. That we don't come at everything that way all the time. We're always asking the question, where's the sacred in this? Where's spirit in this? Where is life in this? Where is thriving in this? Where is essence in this? How does this speak to me of that? How may I speak of this as leading me deeper into that? All of those kind of interconnections, right? Well, I've been working with a fairly literal idea of going for a walk here, and I want to deal with a point of privilege here in an overt way. I can go for a walk. How fortunate am I? Perhaps you can too. And perhaps you can't. Perhaps your body won't do that. Perhaps your circumstances do not permit that. Perhaps these days, going for any kind of a walk that's longer than from one end of your house to another puts you in a place of unique and easily compromised vulnerability. I don't know. But I know we can't all go for a literal walk. And I want to say, from my place of privilege, acknowledging the limited view of that, that perhaps if we cannot go for a literal walk, then perhaps we can take our imaginations for a stroll. Perhaps into a space where we consider how, in the one that binds all things together, we are never truly alone. That idea in itself might help us reconsider the way we interact with others, both locally and globally. And if we think about the whole world that way, I think it increases the likelihood of us working toward an integrated world, a world more in balance than we would otherwise. Well, take it for what it's worth. Muse upon it. Take it for a walk. See if there's something there. If there is, pick it up. If there isn't, leave it where you found it. The ideas may not be timely, they may not be for you, they may be easy to integrate and pick up. No way for me to know, but I do know that I regard it as a great privilege to be together with this group of people and to consider how we might live a life that is more at balance, more integrated, more at one with one another, with the world around us, with all that is sacred. Peace to you all. I hope you have a lovely Sunday and long weekend. And we'll chat again soon. Bye for now.